Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
There's historically, as we all know, been this big divide between science and religion and suspicion on both sides. So we need to work very hard to try to bridge that gap. To try to communicate, I think, from the side of religion, that just because we identify as people with a faith-based lens does not mean that we are anti-technology or anti-science. It means rather that we see the value of science often, and we see the value to such a degree that we can understand how important it is and how life-changing it can be.
My name is Pablo Andrés Ruiz-Salmones, and I will be your podcast host. Today's episode is from an event in October 2025. We interviewed Mohamed Ghali, Corey LeBrec, and Tracy Trothan about the increasing influence AI has in our daily lives, whether in health or psychology fields, among others. We also discussed the growing power of AI companies and the emerging opportunities for various religions across the world to have a say on the ethical debate of AI. Listen now to our conversation.
Today, I think we have such a wonderful, wonderful event. We're going to be talking about the ethics of life and mind in the era of AI. So as you might imagine, that is such a broad topic, and it's also such an interesting topic that has many, very many perspectives. And to do that, we have three wonderful speakers joining us and who we are honored to have with us today. So we have Dr. Mohamed Ghali, who's a professor of Islam and biomedical ethics at the Research Center for Islamic Legislation and Ethics, holding degrees in Islamic studies from Al-Azhar University and Leiden University, where he earned his PhD. His primary expertise lies at the intersection of Islamic ethics and biomedical sciences, a field in which he is highly published with over 30 peer-reviewed articles and the leadership roles as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Islamic Ethics and as lead principal investigator on several funded research projects. We also have Corey LeBrec, who's an associate professor of bioethics and theological ethics and chair of educational leadership in the ethics of life at the Faculty of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of Laval in Quebec. Corey's research lies at the intersection of religion, medicine, biotechnology, environment, and ethics. And we have Tracy Trothan as well, who's a professor of ethics at Queen's University, jointly appointed to the School of Religion and the School of Rehabilitation Therapy. A certified spiritual care supervisor by the Canadian Association of Spiritual Care, she specializes in spirituality, artificial intelligence, moral distress, technology, and aging adults. Trothan holds a Bachelor of Arts and a Master of Divinity from Queen's University and a Doctor of Theology from the University of Toronto. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you here with us. First and foremost, it's very important to ask, well, why are these questions worth asking? I mean, what's the significance in the era that we're living when it comes to discussing the ethics of life and mind? Why is that an important topic? What are the consequences if we don't discuss it? Tracy, perhaps you can start with that question. Why do you think this is worth discussing, and what are the main points do you think that you think are worth discussing in the ethics of life and mind in the era of AI?
Well, it's good to start off with such a small, easy question, Pablo. Thank you for asking that. It's huge. It's so important that we talk about AI in the context of faith and get faith-informed voices out there in the public square engaging with AI, because, of course, AI isn't just a tool. It's something new. It's something different. And if we stand by and we don't talk about it, we're going to see this echo chamber effect of AI promoting and amplifying our biases and our systems of power more and more extreme. It's going to become a worse world to live in. AI is stirring up questions of relationship, of meaning, of who we are, who we are meant to be, all those virtue ethics questions of who we want to become and who we believe we are supposed to become in a faith context. It stirs up questions about harms to our environment, to ecology, excessive use of drinking water and minerals, among many other things. If we don't talk about AI from a set of values that are faith-informed, what we believe in, then we are going to see AI, I believe, just be pursued only or almost only for profit and just to see what it is we are capable of doing scientifically, rather than gearing it more deliberately and intentionally towards values that are important to us.
Following on that you were saying right now, about who we want to become and, to be used for something other than just a profit. Mohammed and Corey, if one of you wants to jump in on this, what do we expect to get out of these discussions, right? What is the ultimate goal of having a discussion like this? Is it providing some knowledge to a broader audience? Is it influencing the decisions that businesses and politicians and other people in positions of power are taking on this? What do you think that as a society, overall as a society, can we get from having a discussion on how to involve on the ethics of life and mind in the era of AI?
I think because of the ubiquity of it all, right? There are so few spheres of human interaction that have not been touched in some way by AI, to be sure, that we have no choice but to be asking these kinds of questions. And I think ethicists, our mandate in many ways is to raise the questions to the fore, right? Let's raise these concepts, these questions, the ideas that we need to kind of have discussions around, because we might not have a direct hand in the development of something like AI, but we certainly have an indirect hand in terms of swaying the market and swaying where consumption happens and so on and so forth. I think about the fields that I work in. I work in the field of education, I work in the field of healthcare, but media and military and environment and urban planning with smart cities and transportation with autonomous vehicles, human resources. People are even talking about digital religion now, as we well know, and that's been a few decades to be sure, but that's coming back into the woodwork. And so I think the topic is worth discussing with as many people as we have who are interested in listening, at least because of its pervasiveness, right? It's just everywhere we go, it seems to be moving its way into not just conversation, but what we do on the ground. And I think of other important issues that we need to kind of talk about and wrap our heads around, like the concentration of power that we see not only in the development of, but of thinking about who's behind, the development of AI writ large. Who has a lot of the power in terms of how it comes to the fore? I think about the trivialization of work that I think a lot of people have things to talk about. Just very quickly, it always irks me when I hear about the great promises of AI that will come and take over the trivial, banal kinds of rote routine types of work that we can now be released and liberated from so we can get on to better, bigger and better things. My father died when I was very small. My mother worked at these. Doing these kinds of what I think people would call trivial, repetitive work that put food on our table. So I think we have to be careful about the banalization or the trivialization of work that we often see in these kinds of conversations. I think about other things like, questions around access and development and the reduction of humans to being just data suppliers. I'm deeply concerned about dignity being linked to human function. And so the more functional we are, the more dignity we have, as opposed to something that is inherent to the human condition. And I think about, and I'll end it with this, the hyper-technologization of everything that can lead to, I think Tracy was mentioning this too, to dehumanization in many ways. I'm reminded of a quote by the former Pope Benedict XVI, who once said that illness and death are seen more and more as technical problems technically handled by technical people. There's something that we need to wrap our heads around, I think, in wider discourse there.
Now, Corey, you were just mentioning about precisely as humans that sometimes they were becoming, in the eyes of some people, data suppliers, right? Rather, and you're saying it's important to keep the dignity and everything related to it. And of course, I think that we as humans are certainly much more than just data suppliers, but I think we sometimes identify ourselves with the jobs that we do, and we're far more than that, right? We're just so much more than that. So, Mohammed, I'd love to have your take on this. Given this phenomenon that just happened of this poster that said stop hiring humans, how do you think these discussions that we're having right now can have an impact on perhaps shaping the narrative, considering as well what Corey was saying of, well, who's got the power in this? Who's got the power behind these different organizations, behind these companies? How do you think that these discussions can have an impact on shaping that narrative, shaping it perhaps in a more human way than the one we just saw in this poster?
Thank you so much. Thanks for the question and thanks for the discussion and for having me on this platform. It's my great pleasure. I'll start with the slogan that you have just mentioned, stop hiring humans or stop hiring them. If we may say now, speaking about biotech, this is the symptom. This is the symptom, but the condition is much deeper than that. AI, to my mind and to many of our colleagues in the field of ethics, AI is not a neutral technology, is not a tool. AI is a shift-making revolution. It's something that can be compared to electricity, to internet, to printing. And it's everywhere in our sectors of life. Not only employment, but in saving life, in taking life, education, in work, everywhere. It is not that simple that when I go to ChatGPT or Gemini and I ask a question and I get an answer. It's like the slogan, people just who say, stop hiring men. The issue is much deeper than that. The answers I get from LLMs and AI models, they have been preceded by a very complex process, starting with selecting data selection. What we know is that these LLMs, they take their data from the famous Common Crawl database that archive everything on internet. The religion that I have studied is Islam, where the main language is Arabic. And then we ask, so the main authoritative sources are in the Arabic language. Then we ask ourselves, how much Arabic is in the training data that have been used for training ChatGPT and Gemini and similar models? It's 0.06. For around half a billion people speaking in Arabic, for a civilization for more than 14 centuries that had important periods of golden ages, influencing almost scholarly production around the globe, and they make 0.06 in their training data. So it's very normal when I ask questions to these models that I don't see myself represented. And this is what happens. Even when I ask about books, important books, and I say, do you know these books? The LLMs would tell me, yes, I know, and then they give a very hallucinated answer. Or, and it happens, although this is very uncommon for these models, that they say, no, I don't know, and I've never heard about the book. So I always say to my students, it's like someone, like any of us nowadays, you are biologically living being, but you don't have a birth certificate. So for the modern nation state, you don't exist. Although you are there, you can prove that I am here and this is me. But if you don't have a birth certificate, you cannot go to school, you cannot work, you cannot travel, you cannot do anything. So if these, the so-called low-resource languages and marginalized cultures are not represented in these in the bases used for training these models, then they are biased. And then there is a problem of data availability, data selection, and so on. And then everything later will be quite complex. So this is one aspect. The other aspect is about the power that my colleagues mentioned. The ones who decide which data is selected and how these models will work. So once they have the data and they start pre-release training, they would make questions, prompts, and then they find, for instance, some answers are not in alignment with freedom of expression, or they are not in alignment with spreading hatred or racial discrimination and so on. And then they twist manually the model so that it will not produce such answers. This is power. You decide what's good and what is bad. People behind the screen who are making these prompts and deciding that this is good and this is bad, they are making decisions on behalf of all of us, although almost we are sure they do not represent all of us. Most of the time, they are Western people, well-trained in secular moral traditions, most of the time, not necessarily religious, and of course not Islam and so on. And to make the issue more problematic, these people are not elected. So these tech giants who are now taking the power, almost inheriting the empires of the past, that were political empires, now we have digital empires, they make these decisions without consulting with us. And we cannot decide not to elect them the next time because they are not performing well. These are corporate companies that are moved by the so-called attention economy. The more you get the attention of the people and make them engaged with their platforms, the better it is performing because the shareholders will be happy because we are generating more profits. although these are not the values shared by everyone from different cultures of the world, from different moral traditions of the world. So the situation is quite complex enough to make the topic important and to make us talk about it and approach it from different perspectives to see what kind of agreements or disagreements we have.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mohammed. I want to touch on something that you just said, and I quote, "This is power. You decide what is good and what is bad." So I want to tie it to our next question on that, because healthcare and the ethics of life and mind is such a broad topic, and we could be talking about, for example, the psychological implications of AI, both for like also for different sorts of people. If there are artists, if there are philosophers, we could talk about that. We could talk about psychology. We could also talk about how it's being applied in healthcare. You certainly all have written extensively on that. I was reading a few of your articles. How can we make sure that in some way regulates power under the definition that you just gave, Mohammed, of power, you decide what is good and what is bad? Because in the end, these ethical questions that we're having right now, when we put them into these different fields like healthcare and mind care and all those things, we're also trying to modify, I guess, how certain practices or certain developments are seen as good or bad, right? So how can these different teachings, different things that you see from your perspectives, from your different religions and from your different backgrounds, how can we make sure that they are applied into this development of new technologies, and how to make sure that businesses that are developing these technologies can take these ethical frameworks into consideration?
I'll jump in if that's all right with everyone. Yeah. I have so appreciated the conversation so far. Corey and Mohammed have raised such important points and examples, and yes, who gets to have the power to decide what technologies are good and what are bad, and how do we engage to try to influence or at least contribute to that conversation? I think that one of the most important ways is probably, well, it's through advocacy and education and getting our voices out there through social media and all those other platforms that have been established by technology and AI. There's historically, as we all know, been this big divide between science and religion and suspicion on both sides. So we need to work very hard to try to bridge that gap, to try to communicate, I think, from the side of religion, that just because we identify as people with a faith-based lens does not mean that we are anti-technology or anti-science. It means rather that we see the value of science often, and we see the value to such a degree that we can understand how important it is and how life-changing it can be in either social justice-oriented directions or not. So I think one practical way in terms of how we have this conversation might be to focus on the language of spirituality. The World Health Organization has identified spirituality as a social determinant of health. I'm very interested in aging adults. That's part of the work that I do here at Queen's University as an ethicist. And there are, you know, some wonderful ways that we can be using AI to help mitigate loneliness, for example, of aging adults, of anyone. Question is, how do we use that? Do we rely on it exclusively and take the human interaction and relationship and care out of the equation? Or do we seek to use it as a supplement without letting society off the hook for providing good care, for taking responsibility to provide good care? So this requires engaging in the political sphere as well as with tech communities and tech creators. If it's framed in such a way that we can demonstrate that there could be better profit, better usage, better uptake of the technology if it is more aligned with people's spiritual needs as well as with other day-to-day living needs, then there might be greater interest in it. And perhaps that'd be one way to bridge the gap. I think it's so, so important, as both Mohammed and Corey have mentioned, to safeguard human intrinsic worth and human dignity and value. And there are ways, I think, to use technology to support human worth, you know, and not to go too far into where we're only worthy insofar as what we can do, what we can produce, what we can create, what we can buy. because, of course, many, many people in the world don't have access to a lot of these technologies, which is another huge issue. If we're to create more life-giving technologies, then we need to work at making them accessible too.
Following up on that, I wanted to ask, how can we better demonstrate this usage and these benefits on spirituality and in healthcare and mindcare with the use of AI? Is that necessarily tied to more profits from companies? Is it not tied to, you know, having more profits? How can we try to bring this that Tracy was saying? How can we try to bring this together to make sure that we advance this conversation?
So I think I speak for my own religious and cultural context here in the province of Quebec, right, in Canada, where I think religion writ large, and I mean that in a very generalized way, struggles to remain at least publicly relevant. And so I'm always fascinated when industry, for instance, or political partners and so on and so forth, reach out, in fact, to religious institutions to ask for collaboration in terms of ethics conversation, right? We'll ask for the framework that always, or the forum rather, that's provided by some religious communities to have these bigger conversations about existential questions. Let me give you a quick example of where I've seen that on the ground. So as you mentioned, Pablo, I'm a member of the Pontifical Academy for Life, which is a group of academics from around the world that counsels the Vatican in ethical issues in terms of medicine, biotechnology, and the environment. And at our General Assembly in February of 2020, so this is as COVID is quietly and then not so quietly sweeping through the world. At the very end of the assembly, there was something very odd that happened that normally doesn't happen. So these are days of conversation. This happened to be on AI, just as in passing. And we were ushered into an auditorium that's about a stone's throw away from St. Peter's Basilica. And suddenly we came in and we took our places and so on and so forth. And on the screen was this giant word, you know, it was written Renaissance with the letters AI in capitals. So we knew something was going on. And suddenly on the stage, there were some big names representing the European Parliament, the Food and Agricultural Organization. Mr. Brad Smith, the president of Microsoft, was there. John Kelly III, executive vice president of IBM, was there. So movers and shakers of the church and so on and so forth came together to sign a document that was produced by the church, what is now called the Rome Call for AI Ethics. And it's interesting because the Rome Call for AI Ethics is a groundbreaking document, not necessarily because of the principles that are outlined in there, the principles that you would know from other AI documents just in passing, transparency and responsibility, inclusion, security, things that you would normally find in other kinds of documents of this sort. But it was groundbreaking because at the very least in terms of its reach, suddenly we had all of these names being added to the roster of signatories, including the people I've just mentioned. But as of today, since, you know, last years that this has been produced, different types of industry and universities, representatives of the Abrahamic families, for instance, have signed on to this call, pledging to development and thinking about AI in an ethical way as outlined, you know, by those principles. Behind that document, I see, you know, a kind of ancient teaching in the church called the social doctrines of the church that has everything to do with promoting human dignity and economic justice and peace, a preferential option for the poor and the vulnerable, for solidarity and binding the human community. All of that is behind, in many ways, this draft that was signed by IBM and Microsoft and others who are coming to the table saying, at least publicly, we're making this commitment. What happens behind the scenes, I can't say. But at least there is this public testimony, right? There's this public action that some movers and shakers in AI, certainly in the church and industry, NGOs, public institutions and politics, are committing to some serious ethical reflection regarding the development and applications of AI. Just to end my comments with this, technology is a tool that sometimes is a very wonderful tool, as we know, meant to assist and to serve and to help humankind in the world of which we're a part. But as both Mohammed and Tracy have underlined, you know, there are some technologies that are more than just tools. That's a simplistic way of thinking of technology. In fact, we're thinking of transformative technologies now that have deep impacts on human-human relationships, human-earth relationships, and so on and so forth. These are huge, even human-God relationships now. And I think the risk is of said technology being seen as more important than the persons who use it, right? And some people are talking, as you well know, about the enslavement, and I'm very careful about that word, but the enslavement of people to technology. And to end, you know, I think here of Jewish wisdom on Shabbat, right? The Sabbath, that word Shabbat in the ancient texts, right? Doesn't just mean rest. It means to cease from work, to cease from using the resources of the earth, which are limited and so on and so forth. There's wisdom there, I think, to a world that is all about hyper-consumption and hyper-functionality. So I think the religions, in many ways, invite us to pause, not only to reflect, but to be careful about where we're moving.
I wanted to ask Mohammed, do you think that perhaps the different religions and religious institutions can help make these commitments actually happen? Tying up just a small other thought on that question, Corey just mentioned several big names on that, like IBM and Microsoft and all that. But you were mentioning, Mohammed, in your previous answer that there's a huge part of the population that's not taken into consideration throughout these discussions. You know, you mentioned specifically the training data for different AI models, and, you know, that's a very small percentage is trained in Arabic and all these different things. So do you think that perhaps one of the reasons why these public commitments are sometimes not met is because they're not taking into consideration everyone that should be taken into consideration? What do you think about that?
I would like to arrange my answer in a couple of clear points so that it will be constructive and clear and consistent. Mm-hmm. The first one is the voice of religious traditions and religious ethics in general when it comes to AI ethical challenges and the question of power. Yes, the tech giants, they have power. And most of the time, my students, people here in the Middle East, and I'm sure people from other religious traditions would say how our religious ethics can be translated into action-oriented plans that can have influence on the ground and not just speaking in the air. Let's start by saying that the religious voice in ethics, and more particularly in AI ethics, is not a minority voice, because this is usually what is being sold. The tech giants want to have this so-called principalist approach, principle-based. They would develop AI principles. And they say this is public morality. This is universal morality that speaks to everyone. And if you want to speak Islamic ethics or Christian ethics or Jewish ethics, this is local ethics. This is local morality that relates to a certain group of people who share these convictions. Let's say that, based on available surveys with reliable studies, that now we have around 84% of the people, they have a religious affiliation in a way or another. And this affiliation has impact on their important decisions in life, especially when it comes to life and death. We have different surveys showing that. And only 14%, they don't have this affiliation. So when we speak about religious ethics, we speak about the majority of the people. We are not speaking about a minority. But where is the problem? The problem is that, first of all, usually religious ethics is portrayed, and this can be also to us, and I'm speaking about someone who is conducting research on religious, particularly Islamic ethics. The perception is religious ethics is about prohibition. I have a tech giant, I want innovation, I want to do all these important things for improving people's well-being and life, and all the time you are telling me, because in the Bible, because in the Gospel, because in the Quran, this is not allowed, this is not allowed, this is not allowed. Okay, I cannot live with this way, and there is no innovation, and this is against advancement, human flourishing, and so on. If this is the case, I would say this is a problem, and I see this as a problem as a Muslim ethicist. Ethics is not about declaring things as prohibited. I think ethics is about ethicizing life, that you come up with solutions for the people to enjoy their life, but in an ethically responsible way. So when I tell you as a company, when I tell you as an engineer, that this way will create backlash for you from society, it is not good to proceed this way, I have to tell you what is the good way. The people in ethics have to be innovative also. They have to find ways for people to live their life, not only blocking the ways for them on how to move forward. There can be voices from the Islamic ethics, from other religious ethics, that can be, but this needs to get fixed. The other thing is that when it comes to the religious ethics, I can speak a language. I don't hear Arabic or English, but I mean style, format that I use, that does not speak to anyone else except myself. So all the time I'm quoting verses from the Quran that you don't know their context, you don't know their meaning, etc. And I say, okay, but world Islam is a world religion and you have to listen. This is not the way. You have to engage with the people who do not share the same convictions, who do not share the same beliefs, but you have to come up with a discourse that speaks to them, that they can understand, that they can feel, and so on. And religious wisdom people from especially world religions, they believe it's good for everyone. It is not only good for Muslims, and it's not only good for Christians or Jews. It is good for God's creatures. It is for everyone on earth. These things need some reforms from within. How can we have impact, although we don't have political power, we don't have technological power? I say, and I hope that people here with us can agree, ethics has its own inherent power. We as humans always want to be perceived as ethically committed people, even if we are very bad. So they say, I heard or read somewhere, that Hitler, for instance, was using the word peace very frequently in his speeches. He wants to show himself as a man of peace. And we have also political leaders nowadays who are also interested in being portrayed as people of peace. Why is this? Because ethics has power. It's prestige. We like it. Google does not like to be perceived as an unethical company. The same for Microsoft, the same for Twitter. They want to have a good image. And we can tell them, we have the power to convince the masses, your clients, to tell them that this way is not good. Whether these people are religious or not, when we agree together that this product is not good, this line of thinking and going forward is not good, they will know that they will lose clients and they will have problems. And business is very coward. They don't like to take risks. So they will not wait till things happen in reality, but we need to have a rigorous discourse. This discourse should be based on serious research. It's not just activist language and shouting in the desert. It should be evidence-based information. And we should come up with solutions for the people. It is not always about saying, no, no, don't. But you have to open other avenues and alternatives for these companies and for these people, how to ethicize their work and not to make life almost impossible for everyone. I think in this way, we can have power and we can have impact and we can have influence.
Mohammed, you were just saying right now that we can convince like from different religions, and we can convince that, as you said, no one wants to be perceived as unethical. Companies don't want to be perceived as unethical, and that ethics has its own inherent power, you mentioned. That if we have this rigorous discourse, then we can convince, you know, companies, hey, if you do this, your clients are not going to like you. If you do this, your clients are going to like you. How can we have, as Mohammed was just saying, how can we have kind of like a unified and a rigorous discourse on that? Many religions have the same teachings, but they also differ in many different things. So if we use this power that we have, and the power that Mohammed is saying right now, will we guide people, like everyday people, on one path, or will we perhaps guide them in different paths, and that will end up dividing the perceived power that religions have in the eyes of these tech giants? And I know, Tracy, perhaps that you also wanted to mention something else from the last answer, so please go ahead with the question and the piece of information that you also wanted to share.
Thank you, Pablo. There's so much in what's been said, and particularly what Mohammed was just talking about in terms of practical ways to initiate conversation and to, you know, seek a different way of developing AI that is more aligned with some shared values. So I think that in answer to your question, that perhaps one way we could go about this is to first be aware that there are some key shared values amongst the religions, and perhaps try to build on that. One of our own in this AI and faith group, Mark Graves, has proposed that we seek out to develop a compassionate AI. And he has very well thought out argument for not just supporting that endeavor, but he thinks it's doable from a scientific perspective. And I tend to agree, not perfectly, but we can head in that direction. So how do we get the buy-in? Well, again, I would just say again, we need to stand together more in terms of general concepts, as Mohammed was saying, that makes sense to everybody, not just to one religion. At the same time, I don't want to silence the voices of particular faith groups too. So there's got to be forums for people within their faith groups to gather to discuss what is important to have an educational structure, I think, within each religion and faith community to pursue what it is we mean by AI, what is AI, and get these conversations rolling. The general concept of spirituality, again, looking at how religious conceptions of deities, for example, have infused culture. So with that infusion, there's influence on AI, and several people have explored that influence, that implicit and explicit influence on AI, AI being godlike and understood as being godlike, usually at an implicit level. Well, we need to dive into that more and safeguard people and figure out how to handle that. I'm going to make a quick plug for a book that I just wrote with my friend and colleague, Randy Reed, called Understanding Religion and Artificial Intelligence, Meaning Making in the Digital Age, in which we explore general social cultural understanding of spirituality and special things and how that affects our engagement with AI. The other thing that I want to mention, I want to build on Corey's point about the importance of faith group documents, including the Call to Rome, that was so pivotal in getting many other faith groups started thinking about this too. I was just very, very thrilled to be part of a gathering in South Korea at the end of August this year of the new International Financial and Economic Architecture Consultation on AI, which is a joint initiative of the World Council of Churches, which has, I think, 133 different Christian faith groups, the World Communion of Reformed Churches, the Lutheran World Federation, the World Methodist Council, the Council for Mission, World Mission, and United Society Partners in the Gospel. There were approximately 45 consultants and experts gathered from across the world, most coming from the Global South, to talk about faithful action and advocacy regarding AI. And I think the communique that came out of that sets forth a number of practical approaches that faith communities can use to engage with different technological groups and political bodies.
Corey, I wanted to ask you a question based on also what Tracy was saying right now and what she mentioned about building a compassionate AI. That's something that was born here in AI and faith as well, and having these key shared values too, as she put it. I think that in many cases, the definition of things is changing, right? Sometimes now AI is being seen as is being deified, and then, you know, there's changing in the language. I don't know if there's change in the substance of it, but there's certainly changes in language, and people are referring to things and referring to AI in many different ways that, you know, we have not referred to something else other than humans or other than God or gods, or depending on each person's religion. How do you think that we can find a shared value when the very definition of things is shifting and people seem to understand God, for example, in different ways now, and people seem to understand life in different ways as well, based on, you know, how AI is currently evolving. It has, as you mentioned in a previous answer, is in every aspect of life, right? So how can we try to find those shared values, considering the language issue that we're also experiencing and how language is currently shifting?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paulo, because I think that the question becomes, in the shifting or in the changing, is there something that we want to hold on to, right? Mm-hmm. Or are there values, for instance, that we cannot say those can be passed over? And I think this is where the religions, in many ways, as guardians of these kinds of conversations, right, are less opponents in these discussions and much more, you know, kind of allies to have these deep existential questions that are being raised to the fore. So regardless of how our images, right, of AI or of God or of, you know, whatever other images there are that are circulating continue to change, I think, with time, there are certain things that remain in place, or at least the religions, and I'm speaking about the Abrahamic religions in general here, because that's my background, but keep at the forefront of these discussions. Of course, we've heard human dignity, which, just by the way, as a bioethicist, is a word that we use all over the place. It's so ubiquitous now that people are wondering what the definition of dignity is, but I leave it there for a moment. There is something about humanhood that needs to be respected in its inherency, right? That's something that the religions maintain. And I think there is commonality. There is a certain solidarity between the Abrahamic traditions, and maybe because, and I'm speaking now for my own, again, cultural, religious, cultural context, In some jurisdictions, for instance, and ironically, in the name of diversity, we often marginalize or remove voices from the table, when in fact, in the name of diversity, we should be welcoming all kinds of voices, including the voices of religion that are not necessarily competing with each other. Besides the idea of dignity, I think the religions do what Muhammad was saying, right? They challenge what is being what is happening on the ground by asking questions like, well, what ultimately are we looking to achieve with these technologies or with the applications and developments of AI, for instance? What kind of future are we trying to build? And is that future going to include the poor and the vulnerable, those that do not hyper-consume, for instance, that may not fill the pockets of those who are behind certain kinds of development? What are the eco-implications of what we're doing on the ground, right? Our responsibility as stewards to the earth. And, you know, so I think there are these big questions that the religions will raise, religious communities will raise, in order to make sure that we're being attentive to a gap that just seems to be widening between the haves and the have-nots. And I think in many ways, many communities, certainly faith-based communities, are looking at narrowing that gap as part of their mandate, sacred mandate, in fact.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Corey. And Mohammed, one last for you. You mentioned in your last answer that there's ethics as an inherent power. And the things that remain also have an inherent power, because no matter what you do, they're going to stay there. So you have to learn to live with them. What do you think is going to or has the capacity to change with the era of AI, perhaps in this power struggle that we've been talking about throughout this conversation? And what do you think is going to stay? Who will be part of that future?
Thank you so much. This is such a complex question, but I will try to be as concise as possible. I believe in the truthness what the companies say, that AI came to stay. And I think it will stay. It's like electricity came to stay, printing came to stay, internet came to stay, and I think AI came to stay. But staying and remaining with us, if we agree on it, it doesn't mean that we agree on how this AI will stay and play a role in our life. And this is what we need to discuss. AI is coming to raise questions about where we as humans will stay. You know, the singularity hypothesis and the existential risk of AI and what some people say that we may end up, that AI will be the last invention that humans have brought to Earth, because this is the invention that will take it over from them. I'm not from these pessimistic scenarios. I am more into the idea that AI has very good aspects if we make good benefit of it. And it can also be very bad and very harmful for us if we don't do it. So I think how AI will remain with us depends on us, the humans. We need to get rid of the idea of what I call, and some colleagues call, techno-solutionism. If something is technologically doable, then we have to do it. That's not true, and this shouldn't be the principle. Something which is technologically doable can be ethically harmful. And if this is the case, we shouldn't do it. We should look for an alternative. The technology will solve our problem, but will not create a bigger one. We need to get rid of the idea that when engineers, AI engineers and LLM engineers, think that this is a good thing, then it is a good thing for everyone and no discussion about it. And if we say anything, then we are conservative, we are not pro-innovation, we are not pro-science, and all this kind of terminology.
Thank you so much, and for the audience as well. Thank you, Tracy, Corey, Mohammed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pablo.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.